All right. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here. As you can see, we have a very full room. I have a number of members, representatives and senators that will be needing to testify. What the chair will be doing is we'll be opening and recessing various bills that we have to get them in and out so they can continue their work. The other thing I'm going to make is a general announcement here. With all the bills that we have currently scheduled for today, they're scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. Just to make certain I cross the T's and dot the I's, anything that I don't mention as we get through here will be carried over until May 30th if I miss one when we get through here. But with my flight instructions and my air traffic controllers, I hopefully will not miss that. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with House Bill 2598. And Josh, or excuse me, Whitney, if you'll give us a...
Yes, thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. House Bill 2598 expands vehicular assault to include contact with a motorcycle that results in physical injury. The Dash 1 amendment titles this offense as the Milkman Mike Act. The Dash 1 has no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. Again, for everyone that's here, what we're going to do is I'll be taking testimony for the members. We'll be coming back for other public testimony. I want to get Representative Post on his way because I know he has other things to needs to be done. So, gentlemen, whoever would like to go first.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson, state representative from the Albany area. And I just want to say thank you for hearing House Bill 2598. My testimony is on OLS. It's very short. This measure is simple. It adds motorcycles to ORS 811.060, the vehicular assault statute. Currently, the law applies to pedestrians and bicyclists alone. The bill describes that a person commits the offense of vehicular assault if the person recklessly operates a motor vehicle upon a highway in a manner that results in contact between the person's vehicle and either a pedestrian, bicyclist, or motorcycle. Additionally, the contact causes physical injury to the individual. I can describe to you what the reckless part of it is under 161.085, but that's there in my testimony, so I won't slow down on that. I do want to reflect a little bit on the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments ask for a consideration to identify this bill as the Milkman Mike Act, and I got to describe just a little bit to you who Mike was. Mr. Chair, you'll enjoy this. I mean, although you're not a motorcyclist.
Well, how do you know that?
But do you? Well, that's true. I don't.
I had a license once in my life.
Okay.
For a motorcycle.
All right, I'll move on. Thank you.
But that's back in Texas. I understand here they actually check licenses, so.
Great. Mike Hamer passed away about 2 years ago at the age of 58. He was a biker. He lived life to the fullest each day. He was a small business owner in Albany. He owned Affordable Septics. He was a veteran, a patriot, a husband, and a father. When Mike was in his 40s, he had open heart surgery. The doctors told him that he was only going to live about a year. He lived more than a year. He lived for another decade. He died in his sleep. His heart just gave out. He got his name from being known as a man who delivered on his promises. He delivered like the milkman. Mike believed that people needed to be held to a higher standard of accountability when they hurt a biker. And that's essentially what it is, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the bill.
All right. Thank you. Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Bill Post from Kaiser, Oregon. I guess I'm here because I'm the token biker of the legislature. There are others that ride, and I now recognize the chair as a fellow rider. From Texas. They ride differently down there, but no, I'm kidding. But this bill was really important to me because as one who rides daily, in fact, my bike's down in the garage right now, I find as a biker is nonstop is having to deal with reckless drivers who say they don't see us, thus the little horn on the bike that's kind of worthless, and thus the big open pipes that are a little more worthwhile because you wrap those a couple of times and people's attention are gotten. But in the numerous collisions and near collisions that I've had over my biking career of 40 years, the reckless part is what stands out to me in this bill, and that's why I wanted to be a part of it, because it puts us on the what should be, what makes sense, the same level as a pedestrian or a bicyclist. Is we're in a very vulnerable position. We don't have iron around us. So that's really all I wanted to say is just as a biker and as a member of this legislature, this bill was really important to me and to know many, many bikers. We had a wonderful biker rally a couple of weekends ago out in front of the Capitol, and the people were very enthusiastic about this bill. So I just want to urge your passage and thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Questions for the representatives? All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to recess House Bill 2598. Andy, why don't you, I think I'm going to have you stay up here, please. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2597A. Whitney, if you can give us the cover on that.
Yes, thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. House Bill 2597A deals with the distracted driving by the offense of operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile electronic device. We also have the -A11 amendment, which does several things, including raising the offense to a Class A violation for the first offense unless it contributes to an accident. It makes a second offense or a first offense that contributes to an accident a B misdemeanor, and the third offense a Class A misdemeanor. And we do not have the fiscal impacts yet on the A11.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and take testimony from Representative Olson and Director Garrett. And then we'll pick up some other members on other bills.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Andy Olson, state representative from Albany. Almost kind of went a different direction there for a moment. Appreciate, again, to be in front of you for House Bill 2997. Appreciate also that the director of ODOT, Matt Garrett, is with me, too. This measure comes to you from the Distracted Driving Task Force during the 2016 interim. We had four different judges there. We had different law enforcement agencies there. We had a lot of concerned citizens, a lot of members from Department of Transportation itself. And we have what is in front of you today. Mr. Chair, I am interested in moving the -13A amendments is what I'm after. And I know that that wasn't described here, but that's going to be the amendment that will help out and capture a lot of everything. So this measure renames the offense of operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile communication device to cover the operation of a vehicle while using a mobile electronic device. And before going further, I feel like I need to kind of catch everybody up, walk you down a little bit of history. And again, I'm not going to linger on this real long because, again, this too is on OLIS, my testimony. But the history of how we got to where we're at. In 2007, we passed House Bill 2872, making it a traffic violation for a minor to operate a motor vehicle while using a mobile communication device. In 2009, House Bill 2377, we expanded this law to prohibit any person from operating a motor vehicle while using. And then the offense was originally a Class D traffic violation in 2013, Senate Bill 9. We moved the offense up to a Class C violation. In 2015, the Oregon Court of Appeals in State versus Ramos reviewed the legislative history and concluded that the law prohibits talking and texting on a mobile communication device, but not all activities that can be performed using such a device. For example, the old statute would not prohibit the use of someone driving, using a cell phone, and playing Angry Birds. What we're trying to do with this bill is to capture that, and a few other things. I know many of you have received requests from law enforcement community to fix this issue. Many police stopped giving any attention towards this violation due to the difficulty in proving the driver was talking or texting on the phone. All a driver had to do was explain to the officer, "Officer, I was just listening to some tunes." We are addicted to the use of the cell phone and electronic devices while we're operating a motor vehicle. Every one of you have probably witnessed this as you're driving down the freeway or as you're stopped at a traffic light. You're seeing somebody looking down, not paying attention, giving fully undivided attention to operation of a motor vehicle. And I can share at length the statistics on this, but I want to take a look really quick at what the proposed bill does do. The first section of the bill clarifies the definition of mobile electronic device to include text messaging, voice communication, entertainment, navigation, accessing the internet, and producing email. Technology has changed and devices are used for more than just phone calls and text messages, many of which are more distracting, so the statute is being updated to reflect the changes. The bill also clarifies that the phone is not meant to be held in the hand. That's specifically it. That's what this bill is all about, is you cannot hold an electronic device in your hand. That doesn't restrict you from having the device attached to the dashboard or having a manufactured device where you can touch or slide. That's perfectly fine to do that. And the bill also clarifies that the phone is meant to be held in the hand. It may be used in conjunction with a built-in feature. I just mentioned that. But here's the key points on this. Getting a little difficult, real tough on this a little bit more. And I know the director's going to maybe, hopefully you'll talk on that a little bit. House Bill 2597 increases the penalty for the first offense from a Class C traffic violation to a Class B traffic infraction. And then it further increases the penalty to a Class A traffic infraction for a subsequent offense within 10 years or if the first offense contributes to a motor vehicle accident. This bill allows the court to discharge a fine on the first offense if a person completes a distracted driving avoidance course, giving proof of completion to the respective court. And finally, the bill gives ODOT rulemaking authority to establish those standards for the course.
All right. Thank you. Director Garrett.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I appreciate the opportunity to be up here with the representative because I appreciate the leadership that he has shown over the many months specific to this issue and many more. As was stated, House Bill 2597, the A. Engrossed bill, makes critical changes to Oregon cell phone law to ensure that the language matches the capabilities of today's technology, as well as making it clear that the use of a cell phone or a mobile electronic device while driving is not allowed. Now, back in March, I had the privilege to speak before this committee on distracted driving. We spoke to how distracted driving behavior has become pervasive and entrenched in today's society. We spoke to how the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Oregon State Police, and AAA Oregon Idaho brought together professionals from a variety of backgrounds to work as a distracted driving task force, as the representative mentioned. We also spoke to some root cause analysis we did, where we identified core findings from the work of the distracted driving task force, and its number one finding that they put forth was the limitation of the current cell phone law, creating difficulties for law enforcement to incite, or to cite, I should say, and the courts to convict. We spoke about how this presents a policy choice for the state of Oregon here. From that Oregon appellate court ruling, the question before us is, should Oregon law related to distracted driving go beyond just talking and texting? I think that policy choice is in front of us today. House Bill 2597, again, changes Oregon cell phone laws to make it clear that any use of cell phone or mobile electronic device while driving is not allowed. It also increases the penalties, as the representatives say, for breaking this law, as well as providing an alternative course, an anti-distracted driving course that people can engage in if the courts direct. I also, too, want to speak to the A13 amendments, because I think this is where productive and positive conversations have taken place. I will tell you, my professionals at the agency have listened to folks that have raised concerns. And the A13s, I do believe, respond to concerns raised by certain stakeholders. First and foremost, the A13s language allows the exception for amateur ham radio operators to be restored. Concerns expressed by the utilities with the language specific to operating a motor vehicle is addressed, we believe, by changing to a simple phrase, driving a motor vehicle. Again, we have listened. We think we have taken a practical, straightforward approach to address those concerns. We believe the body of the bill, again, is a practical common sense, almost common courtesy, in meeting the obligations and the responsibilities of the privilege of driving on Oregon's highways. 2597, the A. and Gross bill, is a good bill. I believe the A13 amendments have made it a better bill, and the Oregon Department of Transportation supports that amendment. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for this panel? All right, I'm going to go ahead and put on the record, we are not working the bill today because we don't have all the paperwork. I will be sitting down with Representative Olson to look at some things. If you remember, we also had a Senate version of a bill, and there are some distinct differences, specifically in the sanction area, what would be the potential. So we'll be sitting down and working through that to try to fortify where we can have something that hopefully that will, what will pass here would get concurrence on the House side without us needing to go into a conference committee. So that's kind of where we're heading on this one. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and recess at this point House Bill 2597A and Andy, one, let's see. Senator Taylor, I know you just came in. Representative Huffman is not here. Did you want to wait for him?
It's okay. I think we can go. I think it's okay to go without him.
Okay. I'm going to let Senator Taylor go now, and then we'll bring Representative Olson back up on the other bill. So I'm going to go ahead and open up House Bill 2740. I know you have other duties in another committee right now.
Yes, it just,
we're not trying to pull rank on the House, but we just figured we'll get you back to work.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. Just to clarify, what I meant to say regarding Representative Huffman is that although, oh, here he is.
What we're going to do while he's getting situated, Josh, why don't you just give us the overview so knows where we're at.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2740 modifies the crime of trafficking in persons. Under current law, a defendant may be convicted of trafficking in persons if they engage in certain conduct directed at another person, and the defendant knows or recklessly disregards the fact that the other person is under 15 years of age and will be used in a commercial sex act. House Bill 2740 would include victims who are 15, 16, or 17 years of age in the crime. There's also a Dash 1 amendment posted on OLIS that modifies the mental state applicable in cases involving 15, 16, or 17-year-olds. The amendment would require the state to prove that the defendant knows the person is under 18 years of age and will be used in a commercial sex act. With the Dash 1 amendment, House Bill 2740 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you.
All right. Senator?
Thank you, Chair Prusansky. So Representative Huffman and I have one last CSEC bill in front of you this session, and we'd like to think it is a fairly simple one. Currently, one of the ways a person may be charged with sex trafficking is if the person recruits or trains another and then knowingly or recklessly disregards that the victim is under 15 years of age and will be used in a commercial sex act. House Bill 2740 changes the age of the trafficked person from 15 years of age to 18 years of age. This provides consistency between this statute and our treatment of juveniles and other contexts by extending the age in which a person can be considered a victim. Thank you. And I just wanted, it's a very simple bill. We just wanted to go over it really quickly, and I know that Representative Huffman has more to add.
Actually, not much. Senator Prusansky, committee, John Huffman, state representative for House District 59. Between Senator Taylor and Josh, they pretty much covered it. I would just like to add, Josh and I went back and forth last week. Dash 1 appeared, and Senator Taylor and I hadn't asked for it, so I was kind of curious what was happening because we had I think it was unanimous throughout the House in committee and on the floor, so I was kind of surprised when an amendment came up that we didn't know about. So I'm curious to find out about that. But other than that, you guys did a great job recapping the bill.
All right. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and recess House Bill 2740 at this point, and we're going to open up our public hearing on House Bill 3446A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3446A authorizes the court at any time after the successful completion of probation to reduce felony driving while suspended to a misdemeanor if the court determines that it would be unduly harsh for the person to continue to have a felony conviction. There is a Dash A3 amendment that limits the scope of the bill to persons who were convicted of a felony as a result of being a habitual offender. This conduct since 1999 has been classified as a Class A misdemeanor. With the Dash A3 amendment, House Bill 3446A has a minimal revenue and minimal fiscal impact.
All right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Andy Olson, state representative from Albany. I appreciate what committee counsel just shared on that. I hit it on the head with this. And so my testimony is going to be really short. It's on OLIS for you. I have Scott Ramsey with me from the Albany Corvallis area. And this is, and we've been meeting for well over a year regarding this. This measure creates a path relating to ORS 161705 as it applies to certain felonies being reduced to a Class A misdemeanor. The bill provides that a court has authority to enter a judgment of conviction for a Class A misdemeanor at any time after the person has successfully completed a sentence of probation if the person was convicted of a felony driving while suspended or revoked. So a couple things. And Mr. Chair, you'll recall this years ago when we used to have the habitual offender offense, you know, 20 or more violations within a three-year period of time, you would then be revoked. During that time period, if you're driving and issued a citation for that, that became a Class C felony. That's exactly what happened here with Mr. Ramsey. Here's the catch on this whole thing. He's not able, because he has a conviction of a felony wrapped around his neck, and it's been 20-some years ago that this ever happened. And he'll share his story a little bit with you. There's a lot of restrictions for what happens to him right now because he still has this felony conviction. And this is where we're wanting to go, to just create this path to the court to allow them to make that judgment to reduce it to a Class A misdemeanor, therefore opening the door for him on other issues. That's how simple it is. And one other thing, Mr. Chair, you'll like, Josh Marquis from Clatsop County, the DA up there, helped craft some of this language. So, you know, it's almost like it's blessed.
Or he's getting older, wiser in his days, huh?
I'll say he's getting older.
All right. Mr. Ramsey.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name's, for the record, Scott Ramsey. I'm a small business owner in Corvallis. When I got out, I graduated high school in 81, and the first thing I did is went out and got myself a motorcycle. Not the smartest thing for a kid to do. I racked up a whole lot of tickets, actually more like 40 tickets, in a very short period of time. Got suspended for habitual offender, continued to drive, got a suspension. I was doing pretty good on the suspension and actually had a hardship permit and was after time involved and was actually going back to school as a dislocated mill worker. Great program, the state of Oregon. I wouldn't be a business owner today if it wasn't for the Oregon State Dislocated Mill Workers Program. Went back, I was going to school. I got pulled over for a taillight. Hadn't really thought a whole lot into it that my hardship permit was for going to and from work and not to and from school, even though my work had gone bankrupt and they were closed down and I was now going to school. And anyway, that ended up with me getting a felony. Didn't think too much of it 20 years ago or 25 years ago. But here more recently, when I get kids and my business, we have 12 employees. We sponsor the high school softball team. We sponsor the high school robotics team. My wife works for the Oregon State Police. I tried to volunteer at the school. Even though I can sponsor the teams, the school's policy is anybody with a felony can't volunteer at the school. I tried to appeal it. Part of the problem is there's no distinction between there's no minor felony or major felony. And as soon as, you try to explain to somebody, I have a felony for life that I can never get off my record, they assume you've done something horribly bad in order to get a lifetime felony. And I have never caused bodily harm to anybody. I've never attempted to elude. I have never had a DUI. I've never caused any bodily harm to anyone, including myself. And all these things, it was more wheelies and burnouts and things kids do on motorcycles. And it really never really even came close to injuring or causing harm to anybody. Admitting that doing a wheelie on a motorcycle is not the safest thing in the world, but it never resulted in any harm. So it's gotten to the point that it's here more recently. Me and the wife have signed up to be a You know, we have kids leaving the house now, and we have empty bedrooms, so therefore we have signed up to do the foreign exchange student. And the second question on the application is anybody in the household a felon? And as soon as I said yes, that opened up a whole can of worms, a big investigation. I just want to, you know, I've had several people ask me, does this have anything to do with, you know, me wanting to buy a gun? This has nothing at all to do with me buying a gun. This has to do with humility, dignity, respect. You know, I feel like I'm a contributing member of society now. I've done my due diligence. I have a good company. I'm sponsoring school events. I feel like I've paid my dues to society, and I just really don't feel like the lifetime felony is a I don't feel that it fits the crime.
All right, Mr. Ramsey, thank you very much for coming up and giving your testimony. Just for the record, even if you wanted to get a gun, you could actually go through the process as a felon to actually get relief for that, if that's something you wanted.
It has nothing to do with it.
I'm putting that on the record just because I want to make certain people who are listening to this understand there's other things. I fully appreciate and understand as a prosecutor the situation you find yourself in, because our traffic offenses are stuff that can't be expunged. And that's one of the reasons that you're kind of unfortunately saddled with this for the length of time, as compared to other individuals with other type of felonies can, in fact, get relief through the courts. Any questions for this panel? Senator Manning.
Just a comment. Representative Olson, thanks a lot for bringing – thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. This is just the tip of the iceberg on how, you know, how long does a person pay for – crimes or incidents that they have committed in life. You know, you said something like 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
25 years ago.
25 years ago, and you're still paying for it. I think that we've got a broken judicial system. We need to redo this whole thing. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
You.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 3446A? Not seeing anyone. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. On this particular bill, we do not have all the paperwork together, so this bill will be carried over, and we're going to carry this over until next Tuesday, May 30th. So, again, House Bill 3446A will be carried over for work session on Tuesday, May 30th. All right, with that... I think we've taken care of all the members, and looking at what we've got here. All right, I think what I'm going to do is take reopen House Bill 2740, and this is the purpose to take public testimony. Joel, I know you're here. Shapiro, why don't you come forward? Is there anyone else besides Joel who wants to give testimony on House Bill 2740?
Thank you. For the record, I'm Joel Shapiro here on behalf of Shared Hope today. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for hearing the bill. I'll keep this very short. As Senator Taylor and Representative Huffman alluded to, this is a very simple, almost kind of a housekeeping fix. Changes the age at which you do not need to show that force, fraud, or coercion was used in the trafficking in persons statute from, excuse me, under 15 to under 18. And that would kind of harmonize Oregon's state statute with federal law and with most other states. If you look at the chart that was provided in the written materials, the 46 states do not require the use of showing force, fraud, or coercion was used when a minor has been trafficked. And that's in keeping with what we know about minors. They're more susceptible to influence, to persuasion, to manipulation, and to require proof at trial, which typically in a human trafficking case, the evidence at trial is in the form of the testimony of the victim. And to require a minor victim to come and testify to show that force, fraud, or coercion was used is a more extraordinary step that should not be required in order to find somebody is guilty of trafficking a minor. So this bill would fix that. I'll cut it off there. If there are any questions about the bill, happy to answer them.
All right, Joel, thank you very much for being brief. Is there any questions for him? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
At this point, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2740. And we will be setting this for work session as well on Tuesday, May 30th. So with that, we'll go ahead, as I did, close that public hearing. Now we're going to pick up on House Bill 2598. So we'll reopen the public hearing for that. And I have three individuals that have signed up, Paula Leslie, Doug Tiller, and Chris Slatter, excuse me. If you all come forward while they're coming up, is there anyone else besides those three who want to give testimony on House Bill 2598? I'm sorry?
Is that in addition to who's already signed up?
The only people I have on 2598 at this point are the ones I've called up. Mary,
oh, you know what? I'm sorry.
You're on a different bill.
I really apologize.
That's quite all right. So let me just say that this bill is going to move forward. So if you can keep your statements to the points that you want to put on the record, that will help us get through the other couple of public hearings we have today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paula Leslie. I'm the legislative director for Bike Pack of Oregon. Bike Pack of Oregon represents Abate of Oregon and all of Oregon's motorcycle riders. We promote motorcycle safety, awareness, education, and liberty through legislative action. And we work closely with transportation safety stakeholders in order to bring about those that mission statement. We surveyed nearly 1,000 motorcycle riders to get an idea of their top legislative concerns, and driver accountability was number two as their most important. Today we're asking parity and accountability among road users. We're not asking to be labeled vulnerable road users or to be put into a special class. And with that, I'll direct the rest of the testimony to Christopher Slater.
Actually, Doug, did you want to say anything?
Chairman Przanski, I will defer, and members of the committee, my testimony. Representative Olson covered the Dash One amendment that I was going to cover, so I'll defer to Christopher Slater.
And Doug, before we defer, if you'll just put your name on the record so we have that covered.
Doug Tiller, I am the director of Bike Pack of Oregon.
All right, Doug, thank you. And Chris.
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Slater. I am a motorcycle rider and a motorcycle accident attorney. My testimony is in OLIS, so I just wanted to point to three key things I think that should be put on the record on this bill. Number one, I think there's a common misperception, even among members of our legislature, that motorcycles are on the vulnerable users list. We are not. So the careless driving statute escalator, under that statute, as well as the Senate Bill 493, does not apply to motorcycles. I want to make sure that's clear. Two, this only applies to reckless drivers. So there's a mental culpability standard. It's set forth in the criminal code. We're not talking about careless acts. We're talking about acts that involve mental culpability on the part of the offending driver. And the third is that I resubmitted, Troy Costales from ODOT presented statistical evidence at the House committee hearing. That was not resubmitted. I think it's important to have the statistical data that shows the disparate impact reckless drivers have on motorcyclists and their passengers. As I understand it, that's something important for the legislative consideration of any new crime. That's all I have, unless the committee has any questions. I'm more than happy to answer. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Senator Manning first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read through this and reread through this this bill, I understand what the bill is saying, but playing devil advocate, what are the cyclists' obligation if they run into a vehicle or another pedestrian?
The obligations are identical to motorcycle operators as they are to car drivers. And so the reckless operation of a motorcycle that injures a pedestrian or a bicyclist, or as we would propose under this bill, another motorcyclist or their passenger would be similarly punishable as a Class A misdemeanor if they're convicted.
Okay, is that ingrained in this bill, or is that already existing?
The proposed bill does not change the definition of vehicle operator. It only changes the identity of the protected class members of the statute by adding motorcyclists and their passengers to the already existing list, which only includes pedestrians and bicyclists. I'm not a criminal defense attorney, but we have a unique statute in Oregon compared to other states, which don't usually define the class members that are protected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I guess I just want to follow up, Chris, on the statement that you said. I'm looking at the bill just for my clarity. It does not appear, I had the impression that the bill was also going to identify motorcycle operators as vulnerable users of the highway. And you're saying it does not, and it does not appear.
It does not. That's another bill for another day that I think merits further discussion.
And can you tell me if that discussion occurred on the House side or why it was not included here? Because that seems to be potentially in sync with this or the next step.
There was no specific discussion on the record that I can recall. I did make it clear in my testimony before that committee that it we're not on the vulnerable users list, and this bill did not change that.
Okay. All righty. Senator Thatcher.
Following up on what he just said, I'm glad that this actually identifies a reckless state of mind for the driver, not just an accident. But anyway, my next question would be if, kind of following up on Senator Manning's question, if the motorcyclist kind of caused, I mean, maybe both were acting recklessly, is there, contributory negligence or something where you kind of balance out who's at fault?
Well, there's two questions that I see there. One, I'm qualified to answer, which is civil liability. There's always going to be, irregardless of any criminal process, the potential for any party that's involved in an accident to bring forward a civil case. There is comparative fault in that, and Oregon has a 50-50 comparative fault statute as opposed to Washington, which is a pure comparative fault statute. So if the motorcycle operator was more than 50% at fault, the motorcycle operator would not be able to recover damages in a case against another vehicle operator. As to the criminal aspect of your question, of course, I recognize we have a prosecutor and a former law enforcement officer on our panel. I would defer to them and their experience in terms of how it's dealt with in a criminal matter if you have two different participants that are potentially culpable of crimes involved in the same incident.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those case-by-case basis. The officer that's on the field, he or she are going to make a determination as to whether one or both should be cited for their conduct. Then when the prosecutor gets it, he or she is going to look at it and decide and determine whether both should be going forward or how they want to process the case. I've seen cases where individuals that are involved in conduct that both are contributors to it, both of them actually being cited for that. Disorderly conduct is a classic case where individuals are involved in a fight and they're both fighting. Sometimes we've looked at that as mutual combat. Other times, because of the disturbance or issues, they both end up getting prosecuted for being engaged in the fighting in the middle of the road or whatever. Chris?
If I could have just one very short add. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. On another bill, you heard from Dwight Gibbons, who is a client of mine, who was pushed under a car waiting to go onto a freeway on-ramp. And the driver in that case struck him so hard it pushed him under the car, and the car proceeded to go down and struck the barrier and broke its own axle. That driver was cited for careless driving contributing to an accident, the effect of which is a $435 fine. There's no escalator applying to the accident, and so that was the only criminal outcome of that accident was a $435 ticket for the offending driver.
All right. Any other questions for this panel?
I guess I do have one question.
Senator Thatcher.
What was the problem with some of the House members that voted against it? Did you hear what the reasons were against it?
I have not had an opportunity to watch the floor testimony. My understanding is that there is a contingent of House members that have concerns about new penalties or escalating penalties. We had some bills at the House committee that were on the same day as ours, and there is some notion that maybe there's too much criminalizing of conduct going on. But again, I did not watch the House floor debate, so I want to be careful. But that's what I heard.
Okay, Senator Lithicum.
Not so much a question, but just a comment with regard to that. Just a minute ago, we had a testimony about collateral damage and felony conviction that, you know, is there forever, especially in regard to traffic violations. I can see hesitancy for these escalatory aspects of this to you know, lump on and create a quagmire of penalties. We're calling someone reckless and identifying their action as describing their state of mind. I can recognize the problems.
All right. Okay. Any other questions? Not. Thank you all very much. It looks like we do have all the paperwork together and ready to go on this one, so I'm going to go and close the public hearing on House Bill 2598, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2598. We do need the dash ones to include the title for the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2598.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2598. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2598 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2598 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I'll agree to let it go. I may change my mind as I gather more data.
All right. I understand. And I think some of the stuff that you've raised, Senator Lithicum, is really kind of that broader discussion or perspective of our mens reas of how we actually charge people based on the conduct, as Senator Thatcher referred to on the other bill, that on 493, it's criminal negligence, reckless is the next, knowingly is after that, and then the most certain is intentional. So those are just kind of our confines here. Other comments or discussions? Any objections at this point? And it sounds like, Senator Lethicum, you're going to be a yes here and then reserve your right to maybe change on the floor?
Yes, sir.
All right. So it's unanimous. Bill goes forward. I'm looking at who has actually signed on as sponsors for the bill. I'm going to ask that Senator Hansel be the carrier since he signed on to the bill as one of the sponsors. If he is not wanting to do so, the chair will carry the bill. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2598, and we're going to go back to public testimony, and I'm going to go ahead and pick up on House Bill 2597A, and at this point, we have a number of individuals here who want to testify. What I'm going to first ask for those that are coming up to testify, if you have already given testimony, written testimony for OLIS, please do not read your testimony into the record. There's no reason for you to do that. That's part of the record as it is. What we'd ask you to do is highlight the portions that you think need to be verbally expressed to the committee at this point. As I mentioned on this particular bill, do not have all the paperwork, and I will be sitting down with Representative Olson anyway. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and ask for our first three individuals. And I believe it's Jenny Gumlish. If Jenny, if you'll come up, Joe, and it's John something. I can't read the end of it. Johannes?
Junkus,
okay. And then let's go ahead and look and see who else is public here. And I think what we'll go ahead and do is ask Clayton Simon to come forward. And whoever would like to get started, if you'll give us your name for the record and then your testimony.
Senator Prozanski, yes. And members of the committee, thank you for giving us this opportunity. My name is Jenny Goblersch. I live in Otter Rock, which is just north of Newport. I have submitted my letter, which should be in your packets, in which I say the reason, and this is about the ham amateur radio exclusion that we think is so important. Clearly, the intent of the legislation is to go after cell phones and items and text and email and all that kind of stuff. Amateur radio has been around for many, many years, since World War II. And it's basically a simple thing where you just pick up a microphone and push a button. Your eyes never need to leave the road. It certainly meets the two-second criteria that the federal report talked about as far as designing new gadgets that people are going to be using. These are old gadgets. The reason we use them is because most of us volunteer our services and our equipment to our local emergency services department to be available to provide communications when a major event happens or any event happens where normal communications are out, cell phone, internet, that kind of thing. And in order to be useful and available, the radios need to be in our cars. And so that they are available. They also need to be working, and we need to practice a lot. So we do. In my radio, I just monitor dispatch. Occasionally, we'll make a call to a member of my emergency services group just to let them know I'm on the air, and that it keeps me in practice on being comfortable with using my equipment. We purchase our own equipment. If we're no longer allowed to use our equipment where it's most useful, in the car, then there's no need to buy equipment. I mean, that's just the bottom line. That's the sole reason that I'm doing this myself. So I highly support the Dash 13 amendment. I'm very gratified to hear that ODOT and others are listening to this old technology, which is not even close to being as disruptive as even built-in or Bluetooth or any of that. It's not comparable. I have samples here if you want to see it, but you probably don't want to take the time, but it's basically pick up a microphone and talk.
Got it.
There are handhelds. I have to say, they might look like a cell phone. Those handhelds can be attached to a microphone. So the improvement to the language, if somebody is thinking it'll be hard to enforce because it looks like a cell phone if they're using a handheld rather than a mobile, is just to say, use a push-to-talk microphone. Then it's clear to an officer seeing what somebody's doing. They've got a microphone in their hand, not a gadget.
All right. Who'd like to go next?
Thank you. My name is Joe Jonkis. I'm an amateur radio operator. I'm also involved with Jenny in emergency communications. I would like to see that the exemption of amateur radio operators be added back into this bill. Jenny's talking about a microphone. This is the microphone. And this is all I have to do in order to be able to talk to somebody. I don't take my eyes off the road or off you. And that's it. My handheld radio is about this size. And it's the same thing. I do this. To change channels, I push this button or push this button here. And in my testimony, I say that since World War II, that's when mobile devices became available for us to use. Policemen, firemen, ambulance drivers, truck drivers, cab drivers, and amateur radio operators have been operating their radios without it being considered distracted driving. And to my knowledge, that has not ever been a significant problem. And to pass this bill that will eliminate amateur radio operators, it is a tremendous disincentive for us to install equipment at our own expense into our cars. I have installed many amateur radio operators at no cost to those people, their radios in their cars, so that they can use them for this purpose. At the end of my testimony, I say, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We have spent our own money. We've taken many hours to prepare for emergency communications. We are the baby, and if this goes through as it is right now, it'll be to me a horrendous disincentive to install any radio equipment in our vehicles at all, and when the big one hits the coast and wipes out the valley and the coast, we will not be prepared. And for emergency equipment, our vehicles are the logical place to have them, because we have a battery in there. We can operate the radio for a considerable period of time. Buildings and everything else will be destroyed, and our automobiles are probably the only things that we can go to and use. So I would just ask this committee to ensure that the amateur radio exemption be put back into the bill. Thank you.
All right, Joe, thank you. And Clayton?
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Chair and Representatives. My name is Clayton Simon. I'm a sergeant with the Lake Oswego Police Department. I'm thankful for everyone's continued dedication to rectifying a serious issue in regards to driver and pedestrian safety here today. I've served in law enforcement for 12 years, several of which within the traffic division of our police department as a motorcycle officer and traffic accident reconstructionist. And during that time, I worked individually and as part of an interagency team investigating minor, serious injury, and fatal traffic collisions. I've contacted countless drivers for all kinds of unsafe, distracted driving behavior and offenses, many of which are attributed to cell phone use. I've seen and believe that proactive enforcement has the ability to play a substantial role in reducing accidents and keeping our citizens, like the folks sitting here next to me, safe. To be successful here, though, we do need to have a clear view of the law. I believe the improved House Bill 2597 and the -13 amendment addresses the core issue in regards to cell phone use while driving. The bill recognizes the never-ending computer-like capabilities of our current handheld smart devices beyond talking and texting. And this is important because the timing of the device use can come with great risk to ourselves, our family and friends, and even innocent strangers, when motorists decide to use those devices when driving especially. We've all seen the roadway examples, as some of the other folks have talked about. We've seen the vehicle driving well below the speed limit or well above it or varying their speed. We've seen the vehicles that fail to stop at stoplights and stop signs. We've seen the vehicles that drift side to side within and out of their lane. And everyone's favorite, the driver stopped at the green light for no roadworthy apparent reason. We wonder if that driver's impaired quite often, and until we get a decent look at them staring at the cell phone held in their hand or the light glow coming from their lap, they are distracted, unaware of what is happening around them, and this is actually very dangerous. In 2014, over 3,000 people were killed and over 400,000 people were injured as a result of distracted driving-related behaviors. And I've seen recent studies that say that nearly a quarter of all crashes today in the United States are due to distracted driving. As an accident investigator, I've seen too many instances where vehicles drive off the road, slam into the back of another stopped car, or worse, an unprotected pedestrian. And when we talk to the driver, they tell us, I looked up and saw the car ahead of me was stopped, which obviously begs the question, what were you looking at? And we do ask, we do. We don't always get the full answer. It doesn't paint the complete picture. And like most accident investigators, I believe these drivers are distracted, and significantly so, by their smart devices. So we're here today in pursuit of safety and to work towards remedying the setbacks from the recent Court of Appeals case that was already mentioned, which severely limited law enforcement's ability to address the use of smart devices while driving. In our courts, it's not enough to see the driver's mouth moving or their fingers typing. We must prove the typing was text communication and the mouth moving was voice communication. And if we cannot prove this, we cannot effectively enforce the cell phone law. And this is obviously a major safety concern, because a motorist can drive down the road surfing the internet, playing a game, or posting live on social media, and is not a violation of the current cell use law. In Lake Oswego, our citation and warning totals for cell use dropped nearly 60% immediately following after this over the course of the next year. And this is not because there are less motorists using their cell phones, as I'm sure you have all seen, including the driver in the Subaru today that was driving in both lanes on my way here. Without this positive step addressing this issue, our citizens are at the perils of those drivers that are focused more on their phones than on their driving. And as previously mentioned, House Bill 2597 accurately assesses the many capabilities of our smart devices. It clarifies the allowances and expectations for use for our motorists. It addresses and implements the important life and property saving exceptions to the law that must be in place for first responders, those aiding first responders with specialized communication skill sets, keeping the baby in the bathtub, and our public utility responders. And for motorists contacted because of this issue, it creates educational opportunities for them to reduce future distracted driving behavior, which is a key piece. In my the last time I came here to speak, I heard several important concerns voiced in regards to distracted driving, and I agree it is a very large and complicated issue to tackle, one that we will surely revisit over time in several aspects. But in my experience as a law enforcement officer and as a citizen, I found that large, complicated problems don't tend to have one catch-all solution that completely solves the issue. More often, it is a series of measured tactics that address certain aspects of the problem and allows us to tackle the issue from different angles. This creates positive change and helps to reduce the variables on a complicated issue. And driver safety is a very complicated issue. House Bill 2597 addresses a significant contributor to distracted driving and gives law enforcement and the courts appropriate guidance and tools to address cell use while behind the wheel. I support this bill, and I hope you will too. Once again, thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak on this matter.
All right, Clayton, thank you very much. Question, Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First question is probably to staff here. With SB2, the Senate version of this, I think that we had an exemption in there for ham radio operators, or did we?
No, is the short answer. We actually, and it was probably my own misunderstanding of the differences between FCC licensing and amateur radio. So what is in SB2, there is an exemption for two-way radio devices that are through the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, if it's to summon a medical or other emergency help. We didn't, in working with legislative counsel, realize there was a difference in definitions with amateur radios, and so that didn't make it into SB2. We realized that later. In the -A11 amendment, which is similar to SB2 that's on OLIS for 2597, we put that back in. So there is an exemption for amateur radios and the two-way radios, but it is limited for summoning medical or other emergency help, in contrast to the A13 amendment, which just is a blanket exemption without that limitation.
Okay, so with that, I have in my district, there are a number of ham radio operators that work with the American Red Cross in disaster preparedness. Mm-hmm. And I think that they are going to provide a very valuable service for this. So I'm concerned about that if they are not exempt in this bill. The other part that was mentioned earlier, I have a vehicle that is, Bluetooth, so I can call and everything else, just kind of hit the little button and stuff and tell Siri what to do. But then I also have a vehicle that doesn't have that device. And at times when I'm driving down the road, I may get a phone call and I put my phone on speaker and I'm talking to the person on the other end while I'm holding my phone. I'm not dialing or texting or anything like that. I can't see myself doing a bill that's going to hurt myself when I'm not doing anything. So I'm going to be reserved on this one here. It has a couple of things that I need to have done. It has to exempt the ham operator rate. And then we need to take a look at this, because if I'm not texting, I'm only communicating, holding a device. I've seen officers on the road with cell phones, up to their ears driving. So we got to make careful that we don't say that it's okay for some and not for others. So I'm going to be reserved on this.
I appreciate that. All right. Any other questions? If not, I'm going to ask y'all to please step
back.
Can
I just make one more comment? And that is ham radio, amateur radio. We are all licensed by FCC. So yeah, it's not just any radio. Yeah. And we take tests and we're trained.
We're going to cover this through our work session. Okay. At this point, I want to get the testimony in. I assure you that there's multiple things that we have to discuss, ensure. In fact, including it could be that with the ham radar operators that actually have stuff in installed on the vehicles. They may already be exempt. So we're going to work through all this and make sure we cross the T's and dot the I's.
Thank you
all very much for coming forward. My next panel is going to be Craig Campbell, Kevin Campbell, and Bill Fugit. And gentlemen, we are going to be running out of time, so if y'all can keep your testimony short. I know there's testimony already on OLIS from some of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon in support of House Bill 2597 and in particular also the Dash 13 amendments. I realize there may be some additional work that will be done. As we've testified in front of this committee before, AAA has done a number of studies about distracted driving, and any distracted driving is potentially dangerous. However, it's important this session to make current law enforceable and to try to take steps to keep up with technology. House Bill 2597 takes a critical next step to do this, and as a result, it creates an enforceable statutory prohibition that goes beyond just phoning and texting, and that will conclude my testimony.
All right. Thank you, Craig.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to also speak in favor of House Bill 2597, A. Engrossed. You have my testimony, and I've been before this committee on Senate Bill 2, so I won't repeat anything that I've said before. I have submitted testimony that is on OLIS. But I do want to say that this is a very important bill. I'm glad to continue to work with the chair and members of the committee on any additional amendments that you feel are necessary to improve the bill. And I thank you very much for your consideration.
All right. Thank you. And Bill?
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Bill Fugate, the State Police. Also on Senate Bill 2, I presented some testimony then. So just to echo what Sergeant Simon said about the difficulties enforcing this law, last year we know we lost almost 500 people on Oregon's highways. We're just trying to reduce the fatality and serious injury crash rate on the highway. We also did see a reduction in our citations for distracted driving after the Court of Appeals happened. So we just need a law that we can enforce and change driver behavior to keep our roads safer. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Lithicum.
Just with regard to there have been two individuals who testified that there was a reduction in citations. Was there an increase in traffic accidents?
I do know there was a reduction in citations. Right now, I know traffic crashes, fatalities are still trending high, a several-year pattern, but I can get some statistics for you, sir.
Specifically, if I may follow up, Chair.
Yes, you may.
Specifically, I'm wondering if there's a pattern to following the decision. Do we see escalatory incidents happening in traffic situations?
And that's some information I can get for the committee. We'll do pull some numbers and find out for you, sir.
All right. Any other questions?
I guess I have one question.
Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, thank you. What I've heard is that the law, I mean, we're renaming the crime or whatever, the offense. Excuse me, it's not a crime. We are renaming the offense, but there's all kinds of other things coming along with that. Why aren't we just simply renaming the offense? Why the escalation from Class C to Class B? Why all these other prescriptive things in there?
I think that's my answer, Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher. I think that the change, obviously, in the definition is really important because, obviously, it's not just communication devices now that people are using. So that's the change there. In terms of the penalties, I mean, I think that law enforcement has some flexibility there because we really think it's important to be able to educate. And I think that's what you heard from Clayton as well, is there's a huge effort here just to help people change behaviors that are really resulting in increased risk on the highway. So I would say that, you know, we're willing to work with the committee on that. As you know, I supported Senate Bill 2. Frankly, either version, if it actually is adopted, helps us to accomplish that public safety mission.
Yeah.
So that's maybe not a satisfying answer.
But let me follow up on that. I mean, we do have testimony from Senate Bill 2, and we've had it previously, that distracted driving as it comes to cell phones, the attention span and the inability to actually maintain control of the vehicle has been shown to be as great, if not greater, than someone being driving under the influence of intoxicants. Yeah. and the studies have definitely shown that. If you remember the president, when he gave his testimony, he basically wanted to go much further than that in the sense. And so what we're trying to do is set up a process that, one, we have the education. We do have the officers having the discretion, he or she, out there in the field as to whether they even issue a ticket based on what they see. We also have the ability for an individual who has a ticket the first time to be able to defer that out and go through this process. But if someone is going to continue to be involved in that type of conduct and behavior based on the risk and the stats that we have, many feel that they should have a graduated sanctioning process to hold them more accountable as they continue to do that, trying to get them to comply with the law so we don't have a long-term disability injuries or death.
Mr. Chair, my question was, because they were having trouble enforcing the current law with mobile communication device in that they had to prove that their speaking was in use of the mobile communication device and that, you know, other things, other problems with that, and so therefore, why not just change it to the electronic device and then, you know, describing what that means? To me, it seems like that does still go a long way toward back the day before the decision where we had people being pulled over and successfully cited, and I guess it had a positive effect. And so changing it back to where it's enforceable seems like that is really the root desire.
Yeah, I understand that. So we're now getting into discussions to the point of where I want to get the testimony in. I think there's a philosophy thing, it's a policy issue as to why we didn't just change the title and or define what is a use of a mobile device. The issue really came down to, even though how we had it defined before, the courts basically stated to prove the case, you have to be able to show these different things. And the only way that you are going to be able to do that, which I don't think this committee or this body is ready to do, is give search warrant ability to officers on this type of offense to take someone's cell phone and then start looking at it to see what was going on at that moment of time that when they were stopped. So that would open up a much broader, I'm going to say, invasion of someone's privacy that I don't think we as a committee, and I surely believe that this body is going to be embracing. So we're working other ways of trying to get to the same resolution. All right. Senator Lithicum.
One last thought without getting into the weeds. A mobile device for navigation and a AAA map that I picked up for free is, you know, every bit as distracting, especially if I've got the wrong side facing towards me. And we're making one a Class B, a Class A misdemeanor in navigating through that, and the other one's just, quote, distracted driving. Distracted driving ought to be distracted driving and call, even if I'm just chasing that M&M that fell between the seats, I'm now distracted. And it doesn't matter which electronic device or pen or pencil I have lost. I'm now no longer focusing on the road and driving skills. And I think that's an education issue that we ought to address, because right now we've got this fine-tooth comb that can't pick out all of the nits that are in this ball.
All right. I appreciate that. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to be Werner, Marysill, Bruce Anderson. And I have Bob Russell also scheduled to give testimony. He'll be coming up next. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2597A that aren't on the list? Again, if you can have brevity, it will be greatly appreciated.
Sure. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. When I signed up, I marked two boxes, and I probably should mark the third box. Essentially, our position is originally we're neutral on this bill. We did oppose Senate Bill 2, and mostly we opposed Senate Bill 2 because of the significant ramping up of turning a violation into a crime all the way up to a felony. Originally, some underlying concerns were disparate impact on how this bill would impact people who...
Mary, mm-hmm. I'd like for you to tell us what the current issues are, not what the original ones, because we're now at a different stage.
Oh, sure. No, that's absolutely fine. We still have those concerns regarding the disparate impact, the possible racial profiling, and pretext stops. That's kind of an underlying current. However, where we are with the current amendments is we are neutral, but absolutely prefer A13. We believe that the violations are more appropriate. The big difference is A13 has exceptions inside the bill. A11 removes those exceptions and instead essentially creates an affirmative defense. On the ground, what an affirmative defense means is a person can still be cited into court. They can still be prosecuted. It would be up to that person then to provide the prosecutor with information to essentially prove that they fit within this this defense. And so the real difference is people are still going to be prosecuted. There's still potential for prosecution. And so we do prefer A13. We do appreciate that amendment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bruce, you want to go next?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Anderson, representing Northwest Natural. Just a few thoughts that we want to get on the record regarding House Bill 2597. First, I've got to extend thanks and appreciation to Representative Olson for his work and leadership pulling together a lot of issues and concerns on the matter. Safety is a top priority for Northwest Natural. We support sound driving practices by our employees. We've established safety policies as our employees drive motor vehicles on company business. But we recognize and appreciate the very serious issue that this bill is seeking to address. We support the bill as it came over from the House. We do appreciate the clarification from Representative Olson and ODOT regarding the -13s to clear up issues on the terms of operating versus driving. Our crews, as they're driving to a job site, may need to use an electronic device such as a GPS device or some other device in a holder, like a laptop or a podium. Other iterations of the amendments, like the -11s, do cause us some concern. Northwest Natural has crews responding to a variety of different tasks who use a variety of different electronic devices, which they will use in a variety of different ways. We want to make sure that things are clear in this legislation so that our crews don't get tagged unnecessarily with a driving offense because they were responding to a job-related task. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate ODOT and Representative Olson for doing so, and with that clarification, are supportive of the bill in either its present version and with the -A13s. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you, Bruce.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. We too had a concern with the bill as introduced. The word operating we thought could include both driving a vehicle and operating a bucket truck that's parked either on a roadway or by the side of the roadway when we're trying to repair an outage. We actually have a job title of operator. As Bruce, which we thought in the plain language caused problem, as Bruce stated, Portland General Electric also is supportive of 2597A and the A13. I think both of those work for utility crews in terms of not creating the opportunity to be cited for operating a vehicle when a vehicle is parked and we're repairing some equipment. I think that we very much appreciate as well the work of ODOT and Amy Joyce being very patient working with us through these issues, as well as Representative Olson. So the A13s work for us, as does the underlying bill.
All right, Ronan, thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Bob, I think you're our last on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. I, too, was here earlier this year and testified before you on Senate Bill 2. And I have testimony for this particular bill that's up on OLIS so that you can take a look at that. One of the things that's concluded with my testimony is pictures of the electronic logging devices. You may recall that our primary concern is the federal government is requiring us to use electronic logging devices beginning December 1st of this year. Those devices are frequently bundled with other things like GPSs and that kind of stuff. And we felt like we needed an exemption so that we can use the federally mandated electronic logging devices. House Bill 2597A does that. It provides that exemption. So we support the underlying bill. There were a couple of other issues that I expressed on Senate Bill 2. One was the use of CB radios and other types of radios that truck drivers use. That would be nice to have an exemption for those. And Senator Lithicum pointed out our issue with GPSs. We think GPSs are actually improve safety over looking at the map or MapQuest directions. The A13s address both of those issues, so we support the A13s as well. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Bob, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2597A, and we're going to open. Yeah, and on this one here, we're carrying this one over until Tuesday, May 30th, and so it will be back, and we'll probably have an A14s more than likely, building on the other testimony and the other amendments we have, including A13s. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up our last of our public hearings for today, and that is on House Bill 2807A. And Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2807A applies to civil lawsuits involving personal injuries to persons who are unable to consent to settlement, so specifically minors, incapacitated persons, and deceased persons. In these cases, the attorney for the estate or the minor incapacitated person is required to petition the court for approval of the settlement and submit an affidavit of reasonableness in support of that petition. House Bill 2807 provides that these affidavits of support are confidential unless the court finds good cause for disclosure. There's also a dash A7 amendment posted on OLIS. The A7 amendment increases the tort cap applicable to non-economic damages in certain personal injury cases to $10 million and directs the state court administrator to adjust that amount for inflation on an annual basis. With the dash A7 amendment, House Bill 2807 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, before we take testimony, I have five individuals that are signed up on this list, and that's Marguerite, James, Brian, Jim, and Arthur that's at the table. Is there anyone else who did not sign up that wanted to give testimony today on this bill? All right, with that, I'm looking at the clock. We have 15 minutes. That's 3 minutes apart each. Max. Arthur, go.
Chair Brzezinski, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Nearly three months ago, we had a lengthy discussion about the impact of compensation caps on the lives of severely injured or traumatized Oregonians. You heard from victims of sexual assault. You heard from a survivor of child abuse by a scout leader. You heard from a gentleman who was permanently paralyzed by defective scaffolding. The dash A7s are a compromise approach. It's a compromise that is dramatically different than the bill that you heard back in February. The compromise protects the rights of Oregonians, but it is a step backwards from where we were for the last 17 years. For the last 17 years, there was no cap on injuries. And this amendment would place a cap on compensation for injuries. And it's a cap on the compensation for non-economic loss, which, as we've discussed, is the loss of the ability to enjoy nature, to live independently, the loss of quality of life, the loss of sexual function, the loss of ability to walk. The $10 million cap is large enough to ensure community safety. We've had a number of cases where defective products have been have hurt people. And part of the settlement in the aftermath of the injuries is to improve the quality of the product, be it a defective washing machine, be it a defective ambulance, or other sorts of products. In those cases, the threat of the big verdict led directly to community safety for Oregonians. Oregonians have seen settlements already above $10 million, or verdicts above $10 million and settlements above $10 million. So this is a compromise. I do want to be clear about that. It's a compromise that aligns with the will of the voters. Voters supported the rights of juries twice when they defeated CAP's proposed to Measure 81 and Measure 35. It's also a compromise that aligns with the facts about the medical industry. In the last 15 years, we've experienced 38% inflation. And in February, the insurance industry testified that during much of the 15-year period where caps were not in place, the medical liability insurance premiums declined, and especially for the last 7 years. So again, no caps, premiums declining, and we want to go to a situation where there is a cap. And then finally, I want to talk about how proud we are to be part of the 25 organization coalition supporting this bill. So it's groups like ACLU, it's groups like Common Cause, Oregon Bus Project, it's Common Cause, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, a Clackamas Women's Center. And that is a big deal too, because the breadth of this problem is pretty wide. You'll hear from a number of folks from the medical industry, but this is about a lot of different people. And you've heard the tragic stories. I won't go into them, in any more detail. I do feel like by taking the piece about wrongful death out of the bill, keeping that flat, that's a compromise. Placing a cap in place is a compromise. One piece that is still remains the same that I think is fair is that for people who were injured far before the May 2016 court decision with Horton, that their rights stay in place so that the law is basically intact from the pre-Horton days. In terms of caps. For some folks, that won't be the case, but for many, it will be. I'll stop there. I hear the timer going off in my head and on Senator Przanski's face.
Thank you. All right, questions for Arthur. Senator Lithicum.
You mentioned something like number of cases for defective products. How many of those cases land in the non-economic damages arena? It seems like those would be related directly towards economic damages.
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, thank you for the question. It's a good one. So in terms of a defective product, Amber Newcomb was a 9-year-old girl. She helped her mom around the house forever, and she was instructed by her mom to go get the wash out of the washing machine. She reached into the washing machine to grab out the wet towels, and the machine took her right arm and broke every bone in her forearm. And then she had to have 8 surgeries, and after 8 surgeries, this 9-year-old little girl had to have her arm amputated. And so the defective washing machine severed her arm, and now she's living the rest of her life with one arm. And it's that sort of non-economic damage. In that case, because of the potential for a large verdict, the washing machine manufacturer agreed to place a kill switch on the lid of the machine. So when you open the lid, the rotor automatically stops. And so it's in that context that the non-economic damages come into play.
Follow up. With regard to that, how many, you also mentioned that we've already seen awards greater than $10 million. How many awards greater than $10 million?
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, In terms of jury verdicts, we've seen one here recently with a gentleman who was crossing the street in the crosswalk and had his leg severed on the spot by a garbage truck taking an illegal turn. The driver had a bad driving record, and the company had done nothing to discipline or retrain him, to the best of my knowledge. So that was the verdict where it was larger. Where the limit comes into play the most, I think, Senator, is in the negotiations in cases in which there could potentially be a large verdict. I think that the my understanding is that in broad strokes, people have told me that there are confidential settlements that exceed the $10 million, but the cap will impact the negotiations in cases like those.
Let me give you another example. One that came up was the Vasquez case. That was a gentleman who was caught up in the hay baler. That jury verdict came out at 12 something, and then there was a comparative that dropped it down, but it was over $10 million. Right. In that particular case, it's still pending. It's on appeal. And so based at this point, I think the final decision was 10.5 or 12. There's going to be impact based on this bill will actually reduce what the jury verdict was. At least that's my understanding.
Yeah. In that case, the gentleman had his waist was crushed to an area that was very, very narrow.
So if I can clarify, we have two cases that we've identified over $10 million. That are public knowledge.
Well, that's what we know right this moment right here without doing a search. I mean, those are two that I remember having testimony. I have not asked for anyone to provide an OGIN review of all the court cases that went through that reached jury verdicts at whatever level. I don't have that.
And let me just fill in the gap. How many, but in the, you know, the, let's say, 4 million to 10 million range? We don't know. I'd love to see some numbers.
Senator Thatcher.
Without going into specific cases, why would the non-economic damages be tied to the economy with consumer price indexing?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, the non-economic damages cover a whole variety of things in terms of people making their life more complete over the course of many, many years. So one thing, for example, that comes into play is let's say that my life expectancy is cut short because of the injury. And the actuaries say your life expectancy is going to be 10 years. But I'm an outlier. And my life expectancy turns out to be, I live 20 years, then I will, in the economics of the case, the economic damages will be based on the life expectancy. The non-economics will be based on, the additional factors we've talked about. And so that's one instance where people will need additional help in the future that will be inflation sensitive. That would be one example of, off the cuff. I hope that helps.
Just a clarification here. I just want to make certain everyone's on the same page. The COLA meets is focused on the cap itself. In other words, I want to make certain everyone understands if the jury makes a $10 million verdict, that verdict amount is not going to change each year. What changes potentially is the cap and moving it up. And the reason that we have looked at that is because we have found in multiple areas that some things take years, decades, before there's a change in those numbers. And so allowing for that to be changed or modified based on cost of living is the reason for that. You may agree with it, may disagree with it, but that's kind of where we're at.
And just to get this straight, we heard testimony 38% in the past 15 years. If the $10 million had been in 15 years ago, we'd see a nearly 40% increase in that $10 million. So we'd be at $14 million today. Is that correct?
I didn't, let's say, graduate with a math degree, but if that's what, that sounds like it's in the ballpark. just like it was at one point believed in this court and in this state for 17 plus years, there was absolutely no cap. All right. Any other questions or comments for? All right. Arthur, thank you very much. All right. So what I'm going to do is ask the other four, Marguerite, James, Brian, and Jim, why don't y'all come on up? We're going to take as much testimony as we can take. If you want to come back, we can do that. It will be tomorrow. So I'm assuming that y'all are going to be somewhat on the same page as to your positions. And whoever would like to get started.
You want me to start? Hi. I'd like to thank the Judiciary Committee for giving me the opportunity to testify, and I've been marking out chunks, so hopefully this will go fast. My name is Dr. Marguerite Cohen. I'm the legislative chair of the Oregon section of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I'm also a proud liberal Democrat. But today I want to speak to you as an OBGYN hospitalist in Portland, Oregon. This position was created in 2011 to increase the safety of laboring patients by having fully board-certified physicians in the hospital 24 hours a day to respond to emergencies. We also care for the highest-risk obstetric patients in coordination with the maternal-fetal medicine service, taking care of medical complications of pregnancy, such as diabetes, hypertension, drug addiction, and more. Tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., I'll be there. If all goes well, I'll share the joy of birth with families, and if it doesn't go well, I'll cry with them and mourn. And I don't know how it'll go. This is the work I've chosen. It feels vital and primal and reaches back in time before there were medical schools, doctors, or even midwives. Yet, trying as hard as I might, I cannot prevent bad things from happening. Every day I go to work, I take that risk. But I'm in the baby boom generation, and we thought we were going to make everything better. I thought if I just worked harder, documented better, ordered everything on time, I would not be sued, but I was wrong. Do we practice defensive medicine? Of course we do. We work very hard at it. We try to do the best for our patients and give them the best care, but we cannot guarantee that they will have good outcomes. Now we see the practice of medicine under threat from all sides. Insurance companies set our reimbursement, and we can't respond to increasing costs with increasing rates. Half of all maternity care in the state is covered by Medicaid, and women are already having trouble finding providers who are willing to take Medicaid reimbursement, which barely keeps the lights on. And the President and Congress want to cut Medicaid even more in order to lower taxes. We have a shortage of OBGYN doctors, midwives, and family practitioners who practice obstetrics, especially in rural areas. Rural hospitals have difficulty keeping their obstetric units open, and when they close, women have to drive for hours to get to a hospital which still does deliveries. Women who want to try for a vaginal birth after cesarean often must come to the urban areas, since rural hospitals consider a trial of labor after cesarean too high a liability risk to take. Right now, the medical liability insurance pool in Oregon is stable. An obstetrician pays about $40,000 a year. I estimate that I have paid about $1.3 million for this insurance over the course of my career, maybe more, maybe less, I'm not quite sure. If you increase the cap on non-economic damages by 20-fold, our rates will increase and may go up 50% or more, similar to the rates in Washington State. Now, who will pay this cost? Of course, you and I will. As consumers, employers, taxpayers, we will see the health cost of healthcare rise, and access to quality medical care will decrease. Please, for the sake of our patients, doctors, midwives, do not allow this to happen, and I ask that you vote no on HB 2807.
All right, who's next?
I'll go next. Chairman Pszczanski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Jim Dorrigan. I am the regional operating officer for the Doctors Company. We insure about 40% of the practicing physicians, independently practicing physicians in the state of Oregon. On February 28th, I testified in opposition to Senate Bill 487, which proposed having no caps on non-economic damage and bodily injury cases. At that time, we submitted testimony, and we brought in an independent actuary to talk about the impact of caps at different levels. And at the time of the testimony, and there's also information that confirms this, a cap in excess of $500,000 is not effective in reducing costs for insurance or providing protection for providers. This increase in the limit of non-economic damages is 20 times the current amount of $500,000. More importantly, for doctors like Dr. Cohen, this limit of $10 million exceeds any available insurance limits and personal assets that they may have. So going in and dealing with trauma, dealing with high-risk obstetrics, which Dr. Cohen does, puts them at tremendous personal risk and causes them to reconsider their practice, to reconsider their patient load, and to see if they can continue to afford to provide care to our most vulnerable citizens. It negatively impacts access by increasing costs for our highest risk specialties and physicians. And if you look at the costs in Oregon, and the risk, the cases subject to huge non-economic damage awards are the most sympathetic cases where medical care has been provided, but you have a very serious outcome, and brain damage infant cases are the most serious and the most dangerous, regardless of how good the medical care was in those cases. Putting this cap at $10 million effectively provides no protection for physicians and those that conscientiously purchase insurance. It does have the potential to increase costs by 20%, potentially doubling costs in looking at states that have no damage caps. In the Western United States, 16 out of 19 states have caps of $500,000 or less. So Oregon is not an outlier by having a cap of $500,000. This is retroactive. This bill will cover all of our pending open cases that are currently on the books, and we have 89 on the books at this point. And the other thing to consider, in the cases that we deal with, 80% of the cases are without merit or are closed with no indemnity payment. So if the opportunity for higher non-economic damages increases the number of cases, it's going to increase costs. From the studies I've seen, having no caps or a $10 million cap, which is effectively no cap, will increase costs by 20% plus. The cost element of professional liability for the last 7 to 12 years is the one element in healthcare costs that has been under control. Putting in a $10 million cap will adversely impact those costs. So thank you very much, and I encourage you to vote no on this bill.
Brian.
Great. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. We represent over 8,000 physician and physician assistants that practice across the state, many in your districts, and we're here to oppose the A7 amendments to House Bill 2807. Thank you for allowing me to testify. You have my written testimony and have heard from our content experts at the previous hearing, so I will be brief. Most important is that our members understand firsthand what adverse events in healthcare mean to a patient or the family of a patient, and believe the remedy of both economic and reasonably capped non-economic damages should be available in both injury and wrongful death matters. Last year, the Oregon Supreme Court restored a reasonable $500,000 non-economic damages limit to injury cases in Horton versus OHSU. We think the court created a reasonable approach that says the legislature can establish safeguards around damage awards in our court system. Caps are used to balance the need to make available reasonable non-economic damages to injured parties with the need to control unpredictable costs provide a stable insurance environment for our physicians to practice in. We have long believed that a meaningful cap, again, only on non-economic damages, allows physicians to afford professional liability insurance and bring needed services to all communities, including high-risk services such as obstetrics that you just heard about. Increasing the cap to $10 million could also increase costs for the state because they currently fund the Rural Medical Liability Subsidy Program, a program that this committee has worked on many times and has done great work on. If rates increase and funds for the subsidy do not, we could see rural providers and specialties like obstetrics leave their practices. The reason the state has a rural medical liability subsidy program is that premiums did go up when the cap was unlimited and rural specialty providers couldn't afford to maintain practices. The program was created and is maintained today to offset these costs and ensure that Oregonians have access to the broadest possible range of specialty services. And this is not unlike the decision that the 1987 legislature made when they were put the tort cap into place in the first place. Put it in place in the first place. Sorry about that. Without the subsidies offered through the rural medical reimbursement program, specialists, most often obstetrics, pediatricians, neurologists are forced to leave rural practice because the cost of insurance combined with overhead make it hard for these providers to make ends meet. Increasing the cap could also hurt our ability to recruit physicians to the state. When considering moving to our state, physicians will be able to compare this $10 million limit to other states like California's $250,000 limit. Our quick research suggests that a $10 million cap on non-economic damages will be the highest cap in the country. History has shown us that medical liability insurance costs have had a detrimental impact on the availability and affordability of healthcare services in rural areas. This means that rural Oregonians who need high-risk specialty care find themselves without access to critical care and must either forego that care and risk their health or seek services miles away from their home. I understand that the amount of physicians has also been discussed in this hearing and previous hearings. And what I would suggest, and I apologize because I thought we had put this on the record the first time, there's a number of great studies sponsored by the state, from the Oregon Health Policy Board to the Oregon's Office of Rural Health, one specifically on areas of unmet healthcare need in rural Oregon that we will put into the record that just talks about the areas of unmet need, some of which are in your guys' districts. So I think we know that there are areas out there where we just don't have adequate healthcare. I also believe that the legislature should consider the financial challenges to our entire healthcare system and use the tools that's been given to safeguard the system from runaway costs. None of this happens in a vacuum, and you all know that. In other rooms in this building, the incentive packages that are used to help maintain rural providers are also under pressure from the budget shortfalls that the state's currently experiencing. I also want to make the committee aware, and I think some of you know this, of a recent court case that may also disproportionately impact physicians. Earlier this month, the Oregon Supreme Court created a new form of liability that specifically targets healthcare decision making. Under this new loss of chance claim, a plaintiff may recover damages, in particular, non-economic damages associated with a lost chance at a better outcome. We are still trying to understand the scope and extent of this liability that the case just was handed down and what would result from this new type of claim, but it's clear that these amendments could result in greater liability specifically for physicians. I also wanted to mention...
I need you to start wrapping up because I'm almost at 10 o'clock.
I'm wrapping up right now, Mr. Chair. Also wanted to just mention quickly that this is the third version of this proposal, and I understand it's being billed as a compromise. I understand from the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition that they have not been contacted to discuss by the proponents to discuss a compromise, and that this is currently not a compromise with a group of 53 opponents that are listed on the fact sheet that they provided. Finally, I just want to acknowledge that this is a tough issue. We know this. It's hard to quantify non-economic damages, and it's hard to balance the need to have statewide access to providers with fair settlements to families that have suffered an injury or a loss. We believe that the recently reinstated cap from the Horton case strikes that balance, and we oppose these amendments. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions, and thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
All right, so what we're going to do is I'm going to let anyone who needs to leave to leave. There's going to be an opportunity for to ask questions. And so we'll start with Senator Denbrough, but if colleagues, if you need to move on, feel free to do so, and you'll be able to capture this. We're not going to work the bill today, so make certain that's also on the record.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So there's an underlying assumption here, I think, that with the Horton decision, we're going to see insurance rates drop a lot in the state. And if this $10 million cap is put in place, that we won't see that significant decrease in the insurance rates. But, you know, I look around the country and look at studies that have looked at that question, and we haven't really, I can't see, you know, clear evidence that having a cap or not having a cap has clear and consistent effects on insurance rates, which is, I think, primarily what we're talking about here. So, you know, I'm just wondering if we can be provided with comparisons of average rates around the country that show clearly that those states that have, you know, low caps have low rates, and those such as Oregon that until recently had no cap had much higher than average rates.
In my testimony, I show a comparison of rates for three medical specialties for Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco. And Oregon has had a cap and been viewed as a more conservative environment than Washington for some time. The rates in Washington are substantially more. California, which is viewed as a difficult venue, but has a comprehensive medical reform bill, which provides a $250,000 cap. Their rates are substantially less than Oregon. And that bill, the $250,000 cap in California, recently went before the voters and was retained for the state due to the impact that they feel it has on the access to medical care. So in states without caps, there are examples that, you know, the states with very high rates. And I looked at a couple of states that have uncapped damages. Florida, we hear a lot about. We're the largest insurer in Florida. The rates for OBGYN in Florida are $97,000 to $190,000 a year. In New York, which we also hear a lot about, but as an uncapped state, the OBGYN rates are $125,000 to $214,000 a year, and that compares to the rates in Oregon of $40,000 a year. So, I can provide you with a list of rates all across the country and also a list of the states that have caps and the states that don't have caps, but it tends to get fairly anecdotal as you analyze each situation. Litigation environments vary greatly.
All right, thank you. I have a couple of questions. Dr. Cohen, when's the last time that you paid your premiums? How recently have you paid your premiums?
I became an employed physician in 2011, so I have not been paying directly. And as a hospitalist, I work for Providence St. Vincent Hospital, which is self-insured, so I really don't have that information for you.
All right, so you've not had a change in your rate because you're not paying any at this point? I understand
it's
that maybe self-insured. I understand that.
Yeah, it's right. Complicated. I've been an employed physician for the last 6 years.
Right. So, Jim, regarding the, you said pending cases, how many of those cases were pending pre-Horton that are still pending versus new cases that happened since Horton?
I mean, roughly the same balance because we have a consistent number of doctors and cases get settled, cases get tried, but roughly we have 90 to 100 cases ongoing.
All right, I heard you say 8 or 9. Maybe I misunderstood you.
I said 89.
89, okay.
89 was the number of filed cases when I did my study.
Since Horton was handed down 1 year ago, what has been the difference in premiums that your organization is charging doctors?
Since 2002,
the question is, because we're running low, since Horton, because what I'm hearing here is that since Horton, we've had this flushness and we've basically cut rates. I'm trying to figure out how much have you cut the rates for physicians since May of 2016?
For the last 7 years, our rates have been flat. We have not reduced rates as a result of Horton for a couple reasons. One is that we're now seeing the increase in severities starting to come in the cases, so we're looking at a rate increase in the upcoming year. Keeping the cap in place will most likely allow us to maintain our rates at the current level, which we hope to be able to do. So we have not seen a rate increase or decrease
in 7 years. You have not activated a rate increase in this state in 7 years for the physicians?
That is correct, and that's a direct result of the frequency in the state of Oregon decreasing by 20% to 25%, and I believe it's because of the implementation of patient safety and risk management that physicians have undertaken.
And I appreciate that. In the first 6 years of that time, we had no cap in the state.
Correct.
Now we do. All right, Brian, the other question I have for you, you mentioned that the state would have the highest cap. You're referring to states that have caps versus states that have no cap.
Mr. Chair, correct. Yeah, I apologize for that.
All right. Any other questions or comments, Senator Thatcher?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around. Okay, so Lakin decision came along, and there was some discussion of some stuff being capped, some stuff not being capped. And then in 2013, this other decision came down that says, no, there's no cap. And so how do you account for, I guess, rates being affected or not being affected during the time where it was kind of questioned whether there were caps or not, and then in 2013, no caps, and then the Horton decision says we're back to caps. I'm just trying to account for that.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Thatcher, what I can say about that is our direct experience beyond the rates, and that is that when we had problems with rural providers staying in rural areas where the margins are much thinner, prior to 1987, and that's why the state legislature and the governor enacted a state reform package. And then when Lakin came in, we saw costs go up that would drive those providers out of those communities, and that's why we created the rural medical subsidy program that we created to respond to that and continues to exist today. And so that's kind of the area that we're focused on, and we've seen the most impact of this.
All right. Real
briefly, the premium amounts that I'm hearing are astronomical, but then there was some difference that the doctor is not actually paying out of your pocket this money. It's going through your the organization that you work for. So I'm wondering, at these prices, how much are doctors really getting paid? If you can afford to spend $100,000+ for insurance, you got to be making an awful lot of money. That means a lot of poor people can't come and see you. So I'm kind of getting a little disconnection here.
Yeah. In Oregon, no one is paying those premium levels.
No, we're.
Yeah. But in other states, they are. And one of the things I looked at is some of the costs per capita for Medicaid and Medicare participants. And those states that have those high costs have much higher costs per capita.
And so, Jim, you know, I'm going to get back to your state, your statements as to Florida and New York giving us what those rates are, the range that they could be paying. And then what you came back to is in Oregon, it's about $40,000 versus what appeared to be at $100,000 plus up to $214,000, I believe. And knowing now that we've not seen a change in these rates for 7 years, that's pretty straightforward. And it seems like even with 6 years of that being uncapped potential damages, that I don't see, Brian, why doctors wouldn't be flocking here as compared to going to New York or to Florida. Any other comments? Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close this public hearing
at this point.
What we are going to do is we're going to carry the bill over till tomorrow, which will be for possible work session. That is tomorrow, which is the 24th, I believe, or 25th. 25th. With that, we're adjourned. Colleagues, thank you very much for staying here to hear all the testimony and the Q&A.